Bye, my little Sebastian.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 163 of Left of Skeptic. My name is Brittany Lind.
And I am Kayla Moria.
And we are a paranormal podcast.
Yes, we are.
Kayla, I love your shirt.
Thank you. It's Sean's.
Oh, I love it. It looks so good on you.
Thank you. It was either a present from his mom or my mom. And I was like, this will work for work. So I'm going to wear it today.
I've definitely started stealing Steve's clothes significantly more just in the last like month and a half. And he's like, oh, you're wearing my shirt. I'm like, uh-huh.
It's been years of this at this point where we're now like, I bought us a shirt.
Exactly.
When we go, it's really actually pretty handy when we go to a show because when it's time to buy merch, we just, instead of spending extra money for each of us to get a shirt, right, we just get one shirt that we share, unless it's Frank Turner, and then I buy five shirts, and they're all ours.
Well, that way you can get two different styles.
Exactly.
If you're like, I want a t-shirt and a sweatshirt, it's yep, like, oh, we'll just get both, and we'll share them.
I have a merch problem at shows.
So I think that's a really good problem to have. I mean, maybe not according to your bank.
but in general.
But it's good for the artists.
Yep. Which, speaking of, I went to go see Alkaline Trio last night.
How was it?
It was so good. They played so many songs. Oh.
That's good. If they played zero songs, it would have been probably a really lame show.
Well, they played a bunch off of Here to Infirmary, which is not a super popular album, but it's one of my favorites and it's one of Sarah's favorites. So I kept grabbing like clips, my little sister, I kept grabbing clips of different songs that I know she loves.
Aww.
And sending them to her.
And then she was just like, I hate you.
No, she was just like, I want to go next time. I want to go. Or it was just a big A-A-A-A-H-H-H-H-H-H-H-H-H-H-H. Like she's screaming at me. So.
Yeah.
It was a very good time. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I got to actually hang out with my family.
Nice.
This last weekend on Friday, I had the day off, so I drove on down, saw every single one of my immediate family, all just broken up. But it turns out, hashtag fun fact, me, my sister, my mom, and my little brother all have central heterochromia.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's obviously like a genetic thing, which but...
Well, and when we get to the end of the episode, I have a listener story this week, and there's some central heterochromia in that, too.
Ooh, is this from Gina?
Yeah.
I saw it come in. I saw it labeled, but I did not open it.
Yeah. I looked, and I was like, this email has been clicked. She clicked the email. Did she read the story?
I did not read the story. No. No, because I saw that the title was central heterochromia, and I was like, what? And then I opened it. I was like, oh, this is from Gina. This is something for the podcast. Oh, wait.
She also mentioned that I didn't even realize I did it. I said bullshit lemonade, which is like a friend group thing.
Oh.
That we do. And as soon as she listened to it, she texted me. She's like, you said bullshit lemonade on the podcast. I'm like, I didn't even know.
I didn't even know. I listened to it twice. Three times. Funny. It's.
Well, I'm glad you and your family all share that trait to be able to see.
To be
ghosts
fucking magical.
And be magical, and I'm just over here with fucking blue eyes.
Yeah, yeah. Lack of a destiny. No magic. You said it, not me.
And I know. I know.
Do you have a joke for us?
Oh, yes. I think we're about halfway through the jokes now. The box is feeling a little
light. Mm.
Who did the zombie take to the prom? His ghoul friend.
Wait. Okay.
Like girlfriend, but.
Yeah, I know, but why the zombie?
I don't know. A zombie and a ghoul? That seems like a good pairing. I could.
I mean, yeah, it sounds like love, monster love, but.
I feel like you're going to get this one.
Oh, no, I'm not going to, and I'm going to feel really bad about myself.
You're magical. You should be able to get it. What do ghosts like to eat in the summer?
Blueberries?
No, but that's good too, actually. That works as well. It's ice cream.
Oh.
But you know what? Blueberries, I like that even better.
Right? Well, it's the healthier option.
Blueberries and scream.
Yeah.
There you go. We are better than the joke cards.
We should be professional paranormal joke card writers.
I don't know how much of a market there is for that.
But well, your grandma bought one.
Seeing as we do this for free, it's anything as a markup at this
right,
point.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You get like 10 cents a box. There you go. 10 cents. Sell a couple of boxes. Maybe we can get enough to be able to afford a newspaper.com subscription.
I know, finally.
I really needed it this week, and I just had to deal without.
Should we double crack into it? We both got a can.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was skill.
That was skill. That was like pretty on point. It's much better than our previous clapping when we used to record remotely.
Okay. So I have had this suggested by a couple of people now. And I think it's because it's either on TikTok a lot more recently or it's just in the news a lot more recently. I noticed there were a lot of newer articles about it. Mm. But today I'm going to tell you about Lake Lanier in Georgia, the haunted and cursed lake.
Yes, I have recently seen this on TikTok.
Yeah, so it's been coming up a lot, and I think people have been seeing it, and they know I have the podcast with you, and so they're like, you or Brittany should cover this. I'm like, well, if you're going to make a suggestion, I'm going to take it.
Yeah, you're better than me, and I still haven't covered that first thing my sister suggested.
So first up, I must give credit to Jamila Nasheed, whose op-ed for Teen Vogue in August of last year was where I got a lot of my information on my location this week. If you want to look it up for yourself, it will eventually be on our sources section of our website, or you can find it by just like Googling Lake Lanier, the history of a black town, enduring racism, and mysterious deaths.
Okay.
Yeah, this one's going to be a little bit deep. But,
you know,
it's interesting.
I already can tell you that mine is going to counteract this one.
Good. Okay. All right. I'm going to bring y'all down. Brittany's going to bring us back
up. Hold steady.
Hold steady. Lake Lanier is a man-made 38,000-acre lake in the Atlanta area that attracts about 10 million visitors every year. This brings around $5 billion annually to North Georgia's economy. So it's pretty important to the state's tourism industry.
Yeah.
The lake is located in the affluent Forsyth County, which has the highest median income in the metro Atlanta area. Mm-hmm. The body of water covers what was once several small communities. Most notably, in most of my sources, is the area that was once a thriving black community that was formed in the late 1800s called Oscarville.
Yep.
The community of more than 1,000 people was filled with successful black families, including farmers, carpenters, and blacksmiths, until they were forced out by the white Forsyth County residents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know this story. It's a bummer for sure.
This area, so important to the tourism industry, this area's history starts with a tale that, unfortunately, is all too common in the U.S.
Yeah.
In September of 1912, a white 18-year-old named May Crow was found injured after being assaulted in the woods less than a mile from her family's home. Her injuries eventually led to her death. Despite the fact that they had no witnesses or evidence, the crimes were pinned on four young black people who happened to live nearby. They were 16-year-old Ernest Knox, his 18-year-old cousin Oscar Daniel, 22-year-old Trussie Jane Daniel, who was Oscar's sister, and 24-year-old Robert Big Rob Edwards. The day after Edwards' arrest, a white mob invaded his jail cell. He was beaten, shot, and dragged through the streets and eventually hung from a telephone pole just outside the courthouse in Cumming, which was the county seat.
Mm-hmm.
Crow's death and Edwards' lynching beget more violence. White mobs known as Night Riders went door to door with torches and guns, burning down black churches and businesses and demanding that all black residents of Forsyth County vacate immediately.
God, that'd be so scary.
The residents quickly abandoned their land, their crops, their homes, most of their belongings. They were just trying to get out and stay alive.
Yeah.
And the white residents picked over and pillaged what remained.
Of course they did.
And then in October, a jury took a little over an hour, an all-white jury, took a little over an hour to convict Ernest Knox and Oscar Daniel for Crow's killing. Trustee Daniel's charges were dropped. 5,000 people gathered to watch the two teenage boys be publicly hanged. Hanged for a crime they were falsely accused of. As far as I can find, no one ever found the real rapist. And no one was ever held accountable for Mr. Edwards' lynching or the mass exodus of black residents that followed thereafter.
Nor did they probably care that much to find them.
Yep. And to be clear, because a lot of times when we talk about this, because this is in Georgia, when we talk about things like this, people's like, oh yeah, the South was really messed up. And I feel like I should mention to people that this was not just a problem in the South. Right here in Duluth, mm-hmm. we have the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial on the corner of East 1st Street and 2nd Avenue East. That is because in June of 1920, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, all black men who were part of a traveling circus, were beaten and hung from a lamppost by a crowd of thousands here in Duluth. The crowd was reacting to a false allegation that someone from the circus had raped a white woman. Mm-hmm. Six men were arrested, but the crowd broke into the city jail to take justice into their own hands. And these events, so that was 1912 and then 1920, these were not that long ago.
No. No, they're not.
Like, it's a little over 100 years ago, which means even if there aren't people alive right now that remember it, there were people that remember their parents talking about it.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah.
And on October 10th, it was October of 23. I'm pretty sure it was October 10th mm-hmm. of 2003. The Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial was dedicated to the memory of these three young black men whose lives were taken. The memorial testifies to the public's commitment to acknowledge its painful history in order to build a more just, inclusive community. And this is the only U.S. monument of its scale recognizing the victims of lynching.
I can't believe it's the only one. It happens so often.
Lake Lanier has no such monument. It does have a small, plaque outside of the Cummings Courthouse where it happened. There is, it was set up in January of 2021 by two brothers whose grandmother was one of the people run out of the town after the incident.
Okay.
They unveiled a historical marker to honor Edwards and acknowledge the injustice of his death. But it's just one monument, and Lake Lanier, the key draw for the area, is named after a person named Sidney Lanier, who was a poet, songwriter, and Confederate soldier during the Civil War. And it's also less than 50 miles north of Georgia's Stone Mountain, which features the country's largest Confederate monument, which, despite protests and legislation aimed at the statue's removal, has remained in place. So, yes, there is this small memorial in the area.
That just went up, what, last year?
2021.
2021.
But it's surrounded by Confederate monuments and, dedications.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, already terrible history.
Yeah. Oh, it gets worse.
Oh, yeah. So back to Lake Lanier. After the 1912 lynching, in the 1920s and 30s, there was a forcing out of the black people who had remained in the area
mm-hmm.
and a mass transferring of their land by and to white residents. Beginning in the 1950s, the area was almost entirely white.
Yeah.
And it actually remained I didn't write this down, but I remember reading it in several sources. It remained mostly white until the 90s.
Wow.
There was a source that listed all the exact
That's an entire generation.
Yeah, but like it was like I think in the 90s, like, can't remember the exact amount. I was trying to remember the numbers, but even now, I guess only like 4% of the people in the area are Black people.
See, I feel like that's the perfect opportunity for reparations of some kind, because that was land that was owned by Black individuals, and
yeah. So according to author and historian Lisa Russell, in the 1950s, the late 40s into the 1950s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wanted to create a lake to provide Atlanta and the surrounding counties with power and water. The government offered locals money for their farmland. Most of it had been in their families for a while, making it almost impossible to put a price tag on it.
Right.
But this is the government. They're going to take the land and do what they need to do. So they sold it all off. And journalist Gerard Kayonga said it best. Despite being built to serve the Atlanta community in need of water source and hydroelectric power, the lake's creation was marred by social injustice and a disturbing construction strategy, which saw locals displaced to make room for the body of water.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually, hundreds of families, depending on your source, it could be anywhere from 250 to 700 families.
Oh, Jesus.
And I think that a lot of times just comes down to what records were actually saved.
Right.
And when I say depending on your source, I don't even mean like, this source is a blog post and this source is like a scholarly source. It varies even within like the legitimacy of the sources as to how many families were displaced.
So maybe one is like the actual count that's found and the other one is the estimation of what the actual count is.
Exactly, exactly. So hundreds of families sold a total of 56,000 acres to the government, which they built a dam on the Chattahoochee River to form the lake. And in 1956, crowds gathered to watch history disappear underneath the water as the lake filled. Today, the deepest point in the dam plummets to about 200 feet. So it's a deep lake. It's a large, deep lake. I mean, it's not Lake Superior, but it's still big.
Well, not everyone can be Superior.
Lake Superior. And also, our lake is real. Anyway, sorry.
It's natural.
It's a natural.
Lake Lanier is real.
It is real. It's a natural lake. And in the area, resentment continued to build as people realized that the money they were given from the government for their land was not really much they could live off of.
Right.
So to prepare the land to be filled with water, the Army Corps demolished or moved anything they considered dangerous. They uprooted trees and hauled them away. A lot of structures were taken down. But there are still a lot of buildings and stuff at the bottom of this lake. There's even a partial bridge because they started taking down some of the bridge, but not all of it, on the lake bottom.
Okay.
One of the sources had an image of it, like a thermal, not thermal, that's not, the, but like, you know, when you use a depth finder that shows you stuff, they had that kind of image of it.
Using like echolocation or whatever?
Yeah. But these communities had cemeteries. And while the Corps identified and moved marked graves, it is likely that many unmarked ones were left behind. And Caesar Yabor, a spokesperson for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, acknowledged that there were probably burial sites left behind.
Now, as it happens kind of all the time, did they actually remove the bodies or did they just remove the headstones?
According to the sources I found, they exhumed the, they didn't like open up the caskets, but they did move the bodies.
Okay.
And the headstones, apparently. But like part of this, Caesar Yabor, the spokesperson for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So there's technology now that you can use that I've actually seen being used when I visited a graveyard before, where they can like go down, like they put a sensor to the ground and try to determine if there's a grave there.
Yeah, they use that in Jurassic Park.
But they don't have, they didn't have that back then. So they were really just going off of what was marked. Yabber said, while the Corps made every effort at the time to locate unmarked burials, the limited capabilities of the time make it probable with unanticipated finds of human remains are possible, whether from the antebellum or Civil War periods or of the Native American origin from pre-colonial and ancient times. So they're saying, I don't know how many bodies are in this lake.
You know, and it would be different if it happened naturally. like those are things that do happen naturally sometimes, but
there are man-made lakes all over.
I know. On the way to my aunt's house in South Dakota, you drive through a man-made lake that has an entire town underneath it.
Oh, I did not know that. I didn't catch that one. Ooh.
I don't think there's anything spooky about it.
It's
I think
just, it's just there. Like, it's just there.
Yeah. It'd be weird to dive into, but...
Over the decades, when the lake's water levels have, you know, dropped due to drought or other things, you can see submerged roads, tire parts, other artifacts that have been exposed within the water.
Spooky. That'd be so weird.
So this is all verified, but Lake Lanier's deadly history is not just from the area before it was a lake.
Right.
I guess we'll start with the most recent because for some reason I put that in that order. on August 3rd of 2023, the body of a 27-year-old man was found in the lake. Days earlier, he had disappeared and it was determined that he had drowned while swimming. The week before that, another man drowned in the lake. A few days before that, a 24-year-old jumped into the lake where he was electrocuted and later died.
What? Electrocuted by what?
He was just electrocuted when he jumped into the lake. It's weird.
That is weird.
Apparently, if you live in the area and are familiar with Lake Lanier, you wouldn't find these deaths surprising. Over the years, hundreds of people have died there, making Lake Lanier one of the deadliest lakes in the United States. Christmas Day of 1964 is known as the deadliest day of Lake Lanier.
Oh.
When a driver lost control of their car while crossing a bridge, the car then flipped into the lake, and as a result, 5 children and 2 adults passed away.
Whoa.
In 2012, an 11-year-old boy named Kyle Glover died at Lake Lanier after being hit by a jet ski.
Oh, that's sad.
In 2023, on the 11th anniversary of her son's death, Tamika Foster, who is a famous fashion designer and Kyle's mother, launched a petition to drain, clean, and restore the lake. The proposal also calls for stricter regulations and zoning for water-related activities, more water safety educational programs, and the acknowledgement of Confederate associations tied to the lake.
Yeah.
As of right now, the petition has over 15,000 signatures, and there is no indication that anybody in, like, the government or that would have anything to do with that is actually acknowledging it. They all say it is too expensive and doesn't make sense to do.
It is a little, like, drain and clean. What does that mean?
Well, so part of this is, and part of the reason that they're making these suggestions is because there is so many drop-offs, it's such a weird lake bottom.
Oh.
That you can't, like, you know when you can drag a lake?
Yes.
Whether it be to clean up. So she's not saying completely drain and empty the lake, but they're trying to, like, basically shut down the lake and make it safer.
Okay.
Like, you would drain some of the level, but it's not like you would completely dry out the lake and then just start picking stuff up.
Okay, that's what I was thinking initially, and I was like, well, that does seem a little...
But you can't, like, it's to the level where
impractical.
I think I read in one article that they don't really even send divers anymore to look for bodies because it's too dangerous for the divers. Because...
Oh, because there's, like, buildings and stuff down there. There's too many things to get caught on.
There's too much stuff to get caught on. There are steep, steep drop-offs. There's unpredictableness because we don't know fully what's down there.
Right.
And what has shifted and moved over time.
Right.
So if you're going to be a diver going into one of like a stack of wood piles or something.
Yeah.
There's no way to safely extract something from that without risking danger to the diver itself.
Right. That makes sense.
So a proposal like this wouldn't be to completely drain the lake. It would be to like drain the level enough to, you know, dredge the lake, do what you got to do to make it a safer, better way to exist.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Okay. That is a much more reasonable request than I initially thought.
In the 7 decades since the construction in the mid-1950s, the lake has claimed the lives of anywhere from 500 to 700 people, depending on which source you're checking.
Right.
But all of them have agreed, and especially I found this one on CNN, more than 200 of those deaths have been people that have died swimming in boating accidents in the last 30 years, since 1994.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a weird uptick during a specific amount of time.
So knowing what we know about the lake's history, I can't even imagine what they would find when they cleaned that lake out.
Mm-mm.
Over the years, divers have reported creepy sightings beneath the murky waters. Some of them are natural, like giant catfish.
Yuck.
One of site said catfish as big as a Volkswagen. I don't know if that's necessarily.
Nine.
I don't necessarily know that that's true, but there was a story about a chicken truck that like flipped and the chickens got into the water and people said they could see catfish coming up to eat the chickens.
Oh my God.
Catfish get fucking huge.
They do get huge.
So YouTube is filled with divers showing videos of sunken houseboats and piles of debris. In 2017, longtime diver Buck Buchanan told a local media that he would sometimes be diving, like to do retrievals of things, and he could feel body parts in the lake during his excursions. Quote, "You reach out into the dark and you feel an arm or a leg and it doesn't move," unquote.
Well, I don't like that at all.
The most logical and commonly cited reason for the high mortality rate of the lake is the fact that it was built over all of this debris.
Right.
It's said to be one of the most dangerous underwater surfaces in the United States. In droughts, the unpredictable lake floor becomes exposed, and ferry boats, cars, and debris of all kind gets closer to the boats and swimmers at the surface. And with the chaotic lake floor makes dredging the lake difficult, it also makes it so that while you're walking in the water, you could, if you don't know what you're doing,
right,
go from shoulder deep water to a 30-foot drop with one step. Which that's one big thing here. That's honestly a danger in any lake.
Right.
But a lot of times people have mapped it out. Like here in Duluth, you know, at certain beaches that you can go out, you know, 50
so
feet
far,
and it'll still only be up to your hips.
Right.
And that has not changed the entire time I've lived in Duluth.
Right.
But, you know, if you go out so much farther, there will be a drop off and you kind of know what to expect.
Yeah.
Here, because so much of the stuff is not a permanent structure, things shift with weather and with currents and everything like that. You don't fully know what to expect
that
at
is,
any given point.
That would be so scary. And then, yes, if something has shifted, you're more likely to get caught on it. If you fall, oh, that sounds terrible.
And there is another theory for the body count, though. Well, two, technically. Some claim that Lake Lanier is haunted, and some claim that Lake Lanier is cursed, or both.
Mm-hmm.
Many people blame the haunting on spirits from the graves that the Corps of Engineers never managed to relocate back in 1956 before they flooded it.
Mm-hmm.
Others fault the phantoms on the 27 victims that are documented that have died over the years at the lake, but bodies were never successfully recovered.
Ah, okay, yep.
The most famous ghost story is known as the Lady of the Lake.
Of course it is.
In 1958, two friends, Delia Mae Parker Young and Susie Roberts, were driving home on their way from a dance. While crossing a bridge, they lost control of the vehicle somehow, falling in the vehicle into the lake and disappearing. The following year, a fisherman discovered a body floating in the water. It was decomposed enough that they were not able to identify the remains.
Mm-hmm.
They only knew that it was a woman and wearing a blue dress.
Okay.
It wasn't until 1990, over three decades later, that the wreckage of the 1950s Ford sedan was discovered in the water with the corpse of Susie Roberts still inside.
Oh my God.
From there, they determined that the unidentified body from 1959 was that of Delia Mae Parker Young. Because she had been wearing a blue dress that she had borrowed from Susie.
Oh, it's weird that they didn't just kind of assume that it was her based upon the clothing.
I guess at that point, with the death count of the lake and just wearing a blue dress, you don't want to assume anything. It's not like they had forensics like we do now back then with the bodies decomposed. They probably suspected, but they didn't have a way of knowing for sure because nobody had recovered
the car.
The car.
Right.
Yep. Locals didn't have the forensic way to know this until that happened.
Okay.
But locals didn't need forensics to believe that it was Parker Young because they had been seeing Parker Young for years, wandering, wearing the blue dress that she had borrowed that night from Roberts around the area of the bridge. Some say she can be seen floating above the water's surface, her arms outstretched as if she's searching for someone or something.
Aww.
According to the legend, she could also be seen with handless arms. So she still had her arms, but no hands.
Okay.
And over time, the story moved to a kind of urban legend that if people weren't careful to avoid her, if you saw her, she would snatch unsuspecting lakegoers and drag them to the bottom of the lake where she met her fate. That's more for the spooky edge.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's fucking terrifying.
Yeah. Multiple people have seen a shadow figure sitting on a raft with a pole inching themselves along the back side to side, despite the lake's extremely various floor depths. And what this raft user has a lantern.
Okay, so it's an older
thing. Yep. there are tales of ghostly figures wandering the shoreline only to disappear when approached. They have heard unexplained sounds like sobbing or faint cries for help echoing over the calm waters.
Oh, that's so sad.
And some say that when you're in the lake, it feels like it's trying to drag you in.
Nothing about this would make me want to go in that lake. Now, mind you, I'm not a big lake person. We've talked about this before. Yeah. Lake Superior is different. But, like, it just seems like it'd be so freaking dirty with all the houses and cars and things that are underneath the water.
Well, and I like going into Lake Superior, but I like going into Lake Superior at very specific points that I have been going in my entire life.
Right.
Because I know exactly what to, like, if you put me in a boat and then, like, took me out to a different section of the lake, No, I'd stay in the boat.
And I wouldn't want to go in the deep end.
Oh, yeah. The deep end of the lake.
So, most of it.
Yes. There are some Google reviews that push for the lake trying to drag you in theory. One said, survivors and anyone who survived a drowning said it was like someone pulled them underwater. Another review said, I swim here all the time, and I swear to God, every time I go underwater, it's like the lake is trying to swallow me up. I also hear that a scuba diver came to check the lake out, and when he resurfaced, he said, whenever he reached into the darkness, he felt arms or legs reaching out to him.
Ugh. Okay, why would you keep swimming in that lake? I swim in the lake all the time, and all the time it feels like I'm about to drown, but, you know, it hasn't happened yet.
Listen, I'm just a Minnesota gal, but from what I understand, it gets freaking hot. Maybe you deal with a potentially haunted lake just for the slight refreshment, because this is a cold lake, apparently. It's like 52 degrees, so cold.
Right. It's not like Lake Superior cold.
But it's a cold lake, so, I mean, I guess at that point, if you're like, what do I risk, ghosts or heat stroke?
I mean, stay in the shallow end, kiddos. Just plop a lawn chair right there and just sit there. And
exactly.
Don't go underneath the water.
Oh, that leaves a freaky thought in your head. Imagine, because we've all done it, where you put your lawn chair in it so you're just like sitting in the water.
Yeah.
And just relaxing. And then imagine you're just sitting in your lawn chair reading a book and then all of a sudden something grabs your ankle and just right in the water.
I just got done listening to an audiobook where there was a dead spirit in a lake. So This is like yesterday I finished it. So this is really well timed and and I'll probably base a lot of my ratings upon that book because it was really spooky.
A journalist named Melissa MC wrote The Dark History of Lake Lanier in May of last year. And she wrote, quote, my source for this information came from a local resident who spoke of strange occurrences and a dark history associated with the lake. Intrigued, I delved deeper and found myself surrounded by stories of ghost sightings and unexplainable accidents. As I spoke with the locals, it became clear that there was a palpable fear of the lake. Many attributed the high number of deaths to the dangerous currents and the sheer size of the lake. However, there were also those who believed in something more sinister at work. My personal experience with paranormal activity at Lake Lanier only added to this feeling. On a late night visit to the lake, I saw something moving in the water, something that could not be explained away by simple, natural causes. My research began with interviews with locals who had experienced strange occurrences on or near the lake. I also visited nearby hospitals and spoke with a staff who confirmed that they received multiple cases each year of water-related injuries or deaths. But it wasn't until I had my own spine-chilling experience on the lake that I truly understood the danger. I had taken a small boat out on the water one evening to witness the beauty of the sunset. But as I sat in quiet darkness, I began to feel an eerie presence surrounding me. Suddenly, my boat was jolted and rocked by an invisible force. The hairs on my neck stood on end as I realized I was not alone on the water. Further investigation led me to discover that the lake was built over a long-forgotten town and that many believe the spirits of those who were displaced and lost in the construction now haunt the water. The strange phenomena reported on the lake includes inexplicable drops in temperature, mysterious voices, and even apparitions. While some may scoff at the notion of paranormal activity, the statistics cannot be ignored. Over 10 people die at Lake Lanier each summer, many of which cannot be explained by simple accidents or carelessness. Until further investigations are conducted, the mystery of Lake Lanier and its deadly secrets will continue to remain a puzzle. But one thing is for certain, anyone who dares venture onto its murky waters should be prepared for the unexpected and to face the possibility of the paranormal. Unquote. So, when you research this lake, like she's talking about, she was talking about like the several locals who told her about their creepy experiences.
Mm-hmm.
In my online searching, pretty much everybody who was local was like, the haunting is bullshit. It's just a dangerous lake with a shitty past. And it's been brought back into the spotlight the last couple of years, as it does in waves over years from what I can tell, because of the deaths and because apparently most recently Margaritaville thinks it's a good place to open up a water park coaster.
What?
Which is what a lot of the TikToks I found about it were about.
Oh.
They're like there, I guess there are some water parky thing, like water slides and stuff, but this is like Margaritaville trying to open up like a full out water coaster on the lake.
That's a choice.
That's a choice. I mean, it, like, it's like we were saying, it's a big tourism attraction for them.
Okay.
So they're going to just try to keep pushing it because they already get so many here, but so many people here, and it's a big draw for their tourism industry. But the locals are all like, yeah, it's a lake. It's dangerous. Respect it, but it's not haunted or cursed. And while I am often wanting, I'll ask you for your rating, mm-hmm. but while I am often wanting to believe, I want to believe, I want to molder it, I think this one is fucking nerd-ass. No rating necessary, normal-ass shit. We grew up next to a big-ass lake. You respect the lake. You realize that the lake can kill you. And you don't do things in the lake that allow the lake to kill you.
Okay.
I didn't want to not cover the story because it had been suggested by a few people and it was very popular.
Yeah.
But nothing about this is giving me curse.
Okay. I do think it's a little odd that you're calling it Nernass, considering you look at cemeteries and you're like, well, they're obviously haunted. Because this is, in fact, a cemetery of sorts.
Oh, well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Okay. Fine. Maybe I'll take back my Nernass.
I mean, you said 27 people that we know of have never been recovered.
Have not been recovered, according to those sources, that there's 27 people that have died in the lake, they believe, but they have not recovered the body. But
that we're aware of. Imagine all the people who are just missing in the area, and that's what happened to them.
But they're not recovered because they don't do the lake diving for bodies anymore.
I mean, yeah, that's fine.
So it's not to say that they're like, ooh, where are they? They're in the lake. The bodies are in the lake.
I feel like that's reason enough for it to be haunted.
All right, I'll move it up to a two, but I'm still...
A two?
I'll give it a two. I'll give it a two.
All right, I'm going to give it a four because I think that at least deserves a three from you, and I need to figure out how to balance this shit out.
So I hadn't actually asked the question that this is for anybody who might be having this as their first episode. We rate all of our stories on a skeptic scale of para to normal, para being five.
Oh,
normal being
just came
one.
Straight in with Nernass, and they're like, "What?"
and we often disagree on our ratings. Not all the time. Sometimes we're like right on. There are episodes where we're right on page with each other, but apparently this is not one of them. So this is going to be intriguing to see how your story goes. I don't know. It's, well, wait, how about this? What if I said this? Because I think I'm stuck on the fact that people keep calling it a cursed lake.
Yeah, just what think if I haunted.
What if I gave it a 3 for being haunted, but a nurnass for being cursed?
Okay, but I think it depends on how you look at curses. Like, cannot the haunting of so many tragedies that occurred on that land contribute to a kind of curse?
Well, it could. It
doesn't have to be a literal person going, I curse you and all your grandchildren.
But in that logic, though, because, again, there are so many of these horrible tragedies all around and all over the U.S., I feel like if that was enough to curse a land, then we would have way more cursed lands than we do. Because this shit is all over the United States.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I think that it's silly for you to call it Nurnass in regards to haunting.
Okay, I'll go 3 for the haunted, Nurnass for cursed.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
See, you can change my opinion sometimes. Not often, but every once in a while.
I think I can change your opinion if I have got some good logic. You're a logical human being, unless you're being super stubborn.
I'm logical, except for my stubbornness and anything that involves my simping.
Spite?
No, not spite. Simp.
Okay.
I'm not logical when it comes for like my love for Adam Driver or Pedro Pascal.
That's I don't get Adam Driver, but Pedro Pascal. Ugh. All right. Tonight, I am going to tell you about the House of Wills.
Wills, like a document, a person, or your will into the world?
I guess you're just going to have to wait and see.
All right.
The House of Wills is a former funeral home on East 55th Street in Cleveland, Ohio.
Because I can't make it on my own, because my heart is in Ohio.
You know, I actually completely forgot that you do that.
I thought you were pausing to wait for me to do that. Nice.
No, I was just taking a breath, but all right. And while it's most famous for housing the largest and longest running African-American funeral home in Cleveland and in Ohio, its history goes even deeper. The Gothic-style 50,000-square-foot building at 2491 East 55th Street was built sometime during the late 1800s, early 1900s. Designed by Cleveland architect Frederick William Streibinger, its original incarnation was the Cleveland Gesangverein Hall.
What is that? What is that?
And the Gesangverein Hall, which was located in a primarily German and Jewish area of the city, was a sight to see. The Plain Dealer, which is the name of a local newspaper, wrote of the building in an article of the club's inaugural concert in February 26, 1901. Quote, last night, the German society, the Cleveland Gesangverein, gave the concert with which they opened the beautiful new clubhouse.
I hope it was polka.
They're singing.
Well, they just said it was German, so my brain hopes it's polka.
Yeah, the German society. The Gesangverein.
you just like saying it.
Gesangverein. The entire house was brilliantly illuminated in honor of the evening, and the rooms were most handsomely decorated with greenery and flowers. The big concert hall was filled with people, and a mixed chorus of over 100 voices occupied the stage. It went on to say that the club is fortunate indeed to have so large and handsome a home, and that the building is a fine one of late Gothic architecture, with a beautiful library and card rooms, as well as an impressive ladies' reception room and commodious cloak rooms.
Commodious cloak room. That's fun to say.
It's fancy. Fancy. It's fancy. Over the years, the building would go on to house a hospital for immigrants from Hungary, the Cleveland Hebrew Institute, an opera house, and a speakeasy during Prohibition, allegedly.
So this place has been hopping for years and years and years.
Yeah, and the lower level was also said to have been used as a gathering spot for high-level Freemasons. And then in...
I still don't fully understand what a Freemason is.
Maybe I'll cover that someday.
Okay.
And then in 1941, it was purchased by a man named J. Walter Wills.
Hence the Wills. Okay.
So yes, yes. It's a name.
Pun. It's a name, but it's like meant to be like a punny, thing. Got it.
And I'm going to go into a backstory about J. Walter Wills because he was a cool dude.
Okay.
So J. Walter Wills was originally an insurance salesman who worked for State Mutual Life Insurance while also attending the Cleveland Law School. He was a lighter-skinned black man, and at times he was forced to pass himself off as Cuban. His boss told him to do that so that white people wouldn't be upset by having him sell them insurance. And he was pretty sick of having to deal with the fuckery of the white folks in the insurance business during a time of segregation and racism. Hence the, oh no, I'm really Cuban thing.
Yeah.
And during his time in Cleveland, because he had lived in a couple different places, but he moved to Cleveland, he was going to law school. And during that time, he became a little bit better known in the black community, which eventually led to him joining a fellow black man named William G., in the funeral business in 1904. G, who was a quote-unquote newly minted mortician, was on the lookout for a partner. And after Wills paid him his share of $250, the G and Wills funeral home was in business.
Okay. I suppose the line to from insurance to funeral home makes sense.
Yeah. And really, Wills was there as, like, G was the mortician, and Wills was there for, like, the business aspect.
Yeah.
So.
Because at that point, he would already be familiar with how all of that stuff functions.
The business, the insurance, mm-hmm. the law.
Exactly.
They originally started in a small office at East 33rd Street and Central Avenue before moving the business to the former house of Wills' deceased father-in-law, John L. Lee, at 2323 Central Avenue in 1905. And this is where Will's flair for business really started to shine.
Whew. That's how I imagine flair for business sounds like. Whew. You say they had a flair for the dramatic, the flair for business. You're just like, whew, whew.
There's a like a rainbow-like arm movement that goes with it too.
Imagination. Anytime you say rainbow-like arm music, I just have SpongeBob.
Oh.
Imagination. Sorry, that was unrelated, but that's all I can think of now.
I don't watch SpongeBob, but I recognize that meme.
There you go.
Now, by this time, he was effectively the managing partner of G and Wills, and thinking that funeral homes were too doom and gloom, he decided to make his as bright and colorful as possible. And he remodeled the downstairs of the house as a funeral parlor while he and his wife lived upstairs. When William G. passed just a few years later, Wills reorganized the business, creating the J.W. Wills Co. in 1907. It's weird to just say co and not company.
Yeah.
And being a business that served all clientele, though primarily African-Americans, the business was a boomin'.
Good.
And once again, it needed to expand. And the business moved to an even larger building at 2523 Central Avenue. The ClevelandHistorical.org website goes on to talk about how much of a pioneer Wills was in the local funeral scene. Quote, in the early years, Wills...
the local funeral scene.
The local...
Like the car scene, the music scene. Have you been a part of the funeral scene before? It's wild.
You know, it's funny because part of his pioneership is about cars.
Oh, huh.
Quote, in early years, Wills used special funeral cars, specially outfitted streetcars to carry coffins. For burials at Woodland, Harvard Grove, and Evergreen cemeteries, Wills used hand-drawn hearses for the short distance from the streetcar tracks to the gravesites. While at Lakeview, there was a special streetcar spur track running to the cemetery. Occasionally, he rented horses and carriages from local liveries before investing in his own carriage and team of horses, and in 1911, an automobile.
Nice. So when they say streetcar, is that like the kind of trolley thing, like it has a track? That kind of what it seemed, but it would be weird to have, wouldn't it be weird to have a trolley that just goes to a funeral or to a cemetery? But
yeah.
I suppose at that point, if that was a good way of transportation, then people needed to get to the cemetery sometime.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Okay.
And what I'm about to say is 100% not based in fact.
Okay.
In my brain, these streetcars that carry the coffins are more like the cars that they have in mines.
Oh, yep.
So okay. They're not like San Francisco streetcars. They're more like mine streetcars. So there's a kind of track.
But not as like steady or used by the general
and
public.
And it's not like a bus.
Got it. Okay.
It's like a smaller thing. And again, no idea if that even ever existed.
It's just something that's
in my head. This is what I'm picturing. And I'm going to go with it. It actually didn't take long for Wills to become the first black mortician in Cleveland to own a funeral limousine. A Cleveland-made Stearns Knight chain drive sedan. Whatever that is. And then later, a black Packard sedan that doubled as both an ambulance as well as a hearse.
All right.
First one.
Saving people, moving dead things.
Revolutionizing the funeral business in Cleveland.
I said dead things. I should have said dead people. I'm sorry.
Well, you don't know. Maybe they also used it for like other things. Anyway, so he was truly changing the funeral game in Cleveland. Again, Wills was not a fan of doom and gloom, everything black and sad. So he became known as the guy to break traditions. And instead of hanging black crepe in the doorways of the deceased, he opted to use colorful floral wreaths handmade by various black florists. He also switched out all of the black funeral parlor furnishings for more colorful ones.
So he turned it from like a place of mourning to a place where you celebrate the life.
Yes.
I love that.
Right? And then the J.W. Wills Co. moved again. When in 1935, the U.S. government condemned the funeral home for redevelopment as one of the nation's first public housing projects. Yeah, he was doing really good. And they're like, no, we're going to put a public housing project here. You have to leave. So that was
God
cool.
God damn it.
I know. So then Wills moved his practice to the former Coble Funeral Home at 2340 East 55th Street. And he heavily invested in remodeling this building. Quote, adding expensive murals, mosaics, oil paintings, chandeliers, and plush furnishings, unquote.
It's like, I am not here for drab.
I'm here for fab.
Nice.
Is that what you were going to say?
No, but I like it. I was just going to say, I made sure my last place was a celebration. This place is also going to be a celebration.
But bigger and better, because fuck you guys, local housing authority, U.S. government.
So what we've discovered is this week we're big on being like, government, stop taking people's shit away, you suck.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the theme this week.
That's the theme this week.
Stop being dicks. He called his new funeral home the House of Wills. Side note, although they are physically, as well as like timeline-wise, closer to our House of Wills, this is not it yet.
So they're not in the building. They're just...
Not yet.
Okay.
They bounce around a lot.
But, man, that is just such a good name. For
the House of
home.
Wills? I know.
Because it's on so many levels. You got the wills, like wills for life. You've got the wills, like the documents. You've got the fact that his last name is Will. And then it's just a good name in general.
It has such like a mysterious vibe. Like, what does the House of Wills mean? Like, what?
Mr. Wills was a very, very, very smart man.
Smart. And one of the reasons why I'm going so far into his histories is because he was also such a cool dude.
Yeah.
A cool dude who did things like, during the Great Depression, he converted the third floor of his building into a large food pantry to dispense canned goods, flour, sugar, and other staples to those in need.
Hell yeah.
And if people were unable to pay for funerals, he would conduct them at no cost.
Hell yeah.
And in a time when black folks weren't always welcome in certain establishments, the House of Wills served as an important home for African-American civic events of all kinds.
Hell yeah.
Which he hosted free of charge.
I like this man.
And then offered free refreshments during them.
Like him so much.
I know. The dude got some money and he's like, I'm going to give it back to the community.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Throughout this work, Wills became an integral part of Cleveland's African-American community and was among the founders of the Cleveland Association of Colored Men, a precursor to the Future Outlook League, the Cleveland chapter of the NAACP, the Negro Welfare Association, later the Cleveland Urban League, and the Phyllis Wheatley Association. He also invested in Dunbar Life Insurance and Quincy Saving and Loan, both of which were instrumental in writing mortgages for African Americans when white-owned firms refused to work with them. And then, once again, he was forced to move his practice. In 1941, the Housing Authority told Wills that they would be taking his home and his business to build Carver Park Homes. And while there was a huge petition and protest to rally against the discriminatory practices of the local housing authority, the campaign inevitably failed. But it gained so much traction that it did help Wills receive a bigger settlement for his property, which allowed him to move into an even bigger building just down the street.
Hell yeah.
And now, finally, we are at 2491 East 55th Street, the House of Wills.
The current House of Wills. Okay.
The House of Wills. And he once again remodeled, dressing the 42-room building to the nines. According to Cleveland.com, quote, it was known for its elaborately themed viewing areas and chapels that took shape in the former club rooms and banquet halls. The most famous were the Egyptian slumber rooms. The yellow and blue spaces had Sphinx sculptures, engraved columns, and decorative molding with Egyptian motifs.
Just sounds like a room I just want to hang out in.
It looks really cool. And the business continued to grow. It employed as many as 50 people and had the capacity to hold up to 8 different funerals in one day.
Holy shit.
I know.
That's too many funerals in a day.
Yeah, one would hope that they didn't have to hold, on average, 8 funerals in a day.
We could do this if we really had to, but we don't need
Fingers to. Fingers crossed that there's no need. It also became a true family affair. Like, Wills's sisters worked for him, his son, J. Walter Wills Jr., and I think he also had an adopted son. And so among the 50 people that were hired at this establishment, a lot of them were his family.
Which makes sense. A lot of times when you own your own business, like even as you grow, you're going to bring your family in on it.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. That tracks.
Yeah, and Junior, he started working there as a teenager and then into adulthood.
Okay.
He's like, I guess this is just what I do now. In 1967, though, J. Walter Wills Jr. passed away.
Oh.
With J. Walter Wills Sr. passing away 4 years later in 1971. After that, the House of Wills continued to be ran by family, even expanding to a second location on Harvard Avenue.
But I suppose it's a big area, so there's call for that. Like, Cleveland is a big area.
It's pretty big.
So there's call for that.
Yeah. But then in 2005, the largest black funeral home in Ohio, the House of Wills, closed its doors, with the Harvard Avenue location following suit 9 years later.
So really recently.
Yeah. And for years, the property just sat there, abandoned. Until a man from Los Angeles named Eric Freeman purchased the building in 2010. He said he had a dream of restoring it for community-based uses, possibly for future use to help juvenile offenders or the homeless. And he put a lot of work into it. And he seems to be determined to keep a lot of the unique elements intact, though it's pretty slow going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took him a decade just to replace the roof. But progress is being made. The quote-unquote lavish casket showroom called the Cloud Room, which is located in a former banquet hall on the lower level, was one of the first places he started to restore.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the 2019 article I found on Cleveland.com, Freeman hopes to begin work on the Egyptian areas soon. He's already updated much of the electricity and the plumbing throughout the building. His hope was always that once he completed a certain amount of the work, the building could then be used as a venue for various events, eventually producing enough revenue to continue the upper level restorations.
That makes sense. I mean, you can only do what your funding allows.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of those events have ended up being pretty spooky in nature.
Okay.
Now, while Eric Freeman has been quoted as saying, "I don't believe in ghosts. I didn't before, and I still don't. But I've seen things here that I can't explain. Those are not the vibes that other people are bringing to the House of Wills."
Okay.
Which has been featured on numerous ghost hunting shows, such as the Ghost Brothers, Death Walker with Nick Groff, the online docuseries Resident Undead, and Kristen Stewart's produced Hulu series Living for the Dead. Though I don't think that the Living for the Dead episode is out yet.
Oh, okay.
Because I looked for it and it's the one I wanted to watch, but I didn't find it on Hulu.
Of course, like of all these sources, you're like, the one that I want is
the one that
there.
I want isn't there. And I know a lot of times, even if it's Hulu produced, it's like offered on a special thing before it's put on like regular Hulu. So season one of that is us up there. I didn't know that. I'm going to have to watch it all because the gay-related puns in the episode descriptions really caught my fancy. So clearly the word is out that the House of Wills is haunted. But by what? Dun, dun, dun.
It's got a big history, a big long history. So it could be anything at this point.
Yeah, yeah. So according to a Medium.com article, there have been many reports of paranormal activity at the House of Wills over the years. These activities range from seeing apparitions to reports of unexplained noises. Cleveland Magazine did an interview with Daryl Marston, who wrote a book about the House of Wills. You might recognize him as a former Ghost Hunters team member. And when they asked him about his first impressions of the house, he said, quote, "The energy of the building. I can only explain it to people as if it was a living entity itself, a living, breathing organism, which I've never experienced before on any investigation I've been on at this point," unquote.
Okay.
One of the most famous ghost stories associated with the House of Wills involves the ghost of a man who committed suicide in the funeral home. According to legend, the man was distraught over the death of his wife and took his own life in one of the upstairs rooms. Visitors to the building have reported feeling a sense of unease in the room where the suicide had occurred, and some claim to have seen the ghost of the man himself. Another commonly seen apparition is the ghost of a former employee who is said to still roam the building. The employee, who was a funeral director, reportedly died in the building and has been seen by visitors wearing his old suit and tie, while others report seeing a ghost of a little girl who is said to play in the hallway.
No, no ghost kids.
Maybe it's a demon. Maybe it's a demon.
I was chill with all these ghosts up until now. I was like, okay, somebody who passed away while in grief, somebody who worked there, this is all tracking, and you're like a ghost child. I'm like, no.
But, you know, it was Ghost Hunters, not Ghost Adventures, but if Zach Bagan was saying it was a demon, so if that helps you at all.
No, it doesn't. Tell me about the little girl.
Oh, that's all you get.
Oh, it's just a little girl.
Yeah,
okay.
It's just a little girl.
Well, then that's fine.
Playing in the hallways.
I guess, I mean, that building was many things. Many things before it was a funeral home.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be like a sad child. It could just be a child that was there for a while and was happy. So we're going to go with happy child.
Happy child haunting.
Yep. I've created a backstory for this ghost child and it's a happy one.
I love that. I prefer that than anything else it could have been.
Yep.
I hope she's not a Hungarian refugee who passed away there. Because it was that for a while, a hospital.
No, this is happy.
Happy residual haunting. Anyway, when Daryl Marston was asked about his time in the house, he said, quote, "When we were there, it was August, so it was pretty hot. There's no electricity in the building, so there's no AC or anything like that. I started feeling ill, like I had food poisoning or something was coming on out of nowhere. I got really cold and I started to feel almost a fever coming on. You can actually see my breath at one point in August. They witnessed it. There's actually video of that as well. Soon after that, it's when I really started to feel weird. And I actually, at one point, yelled out for whatever it was to get off of me. There's a guy who's videotaping me from behind with a hand camcorder. And we were walking up a flight of stairs when I said it. And you could see a black mass shoot from my back into a wall that was directly behind me.
So freaky, but it listened.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You guys couldn't see her face, but she's like, yeah. And then she's like,
maybe. I don't know. That's the type of stuff that was happening in the building. We were seeing shadow anomalies, shadow figures, whatever you want to call them, in the hallways. We were getting all kinds of weird audio, things of that nature. It was a gamut of all kinds of paranormal activity going on in that building at the time. Unquote.
Okay.
People also report hearing whispers or feeling an overwhelming sense of unease, like someone is just watching them.
Ugh.
And Daryl Marston said that it was the House of Wills where he experienced the only incident of something following him home.
Oh, that's not good.
That's why I made that face. Yeah. Which he claims stayed with him for a good 5 or 6 weeks afterwards.
When you leave a haunted location, you tell whatever's there that they are not welcome to follow you home. You say it. I'm not saying it works 100% of the time, but now I'm curious, did this person do that?
I don't know.
Because if so, that's their fucking mistake, eh?
Yeah. Seems like maybe as a former ghost hunter.
They should have fucking known better.
Instead, they're out there all willy-nilly just inviting these things home with them.
Unintentional invitation.
And although there is a book out now called The Horrors of the House of Wills, when he started writing it, he says that it didn't start out with a book deal. He said it was something that he just did during COVID as a type of therapy, and it was so intriguing that he got a book deal out of it.
Nice.
When asked if he would go back, he simply said, yeah, I don't know if I want to put myself through that. And that is the story of the House of Wills.
All right.
Now, before you do the rating question, I do want to say a couple things about The Horrors of the House of Wills.
Okay.
I did not read it.
Because there wasn't enough time, or possibly because it cost money?
I think both.
Yeah, that's
legit. I wrote this today. So, yeah, I didn't have enough time.
But that is legit. I mean, there's plenty of sources we've talked about on the past that, like, we can't afford to buy every source that comes up for all of our stuff.
Also, this Daryl guy. I don't remember him from Ghost Hunters. He wasn't part of the main squad.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that his version of the history, mind you, he might have better sources than I do. He actually went there.
Okay.
But his version of the history, he talks about how the funeral home closed because of fraud.
Oh, okay.
Which was not mentioned anywhere else.
But was he doing that thing where I'm writing a book, so I have to, like, embellish things? Like, and so he took something that was mentioned in one of his sources and then, like, rolled with it and exaggerated it? Because that happens a lot.
Yeah,
books.
I don't know, but it seems like because there were two locations and this one was the oldest one and it closed first, and then 9 years later, the secondary location closed, it doesn't seem like fraud would be the reason why that happened.
Yeah.
It also kind of pissed me off just because this is a black family, and if that's literally the only place I saw it, I'm a little annoyed if he's saying some not nice things about people who are already, like, disenfranchised. They were rich, but, you know.
Yeah. I do think that, because this is why we constantly reference, like, when sources contradict each other.
Yeah.
Like, both of us do this.
Yeah.
Is because so many sources will be, like, they'll read something that said, oh, this happened after a bounced check. Right. And then another source will take that, you know, that,
and like then
that,
be like, oh, and they'll fraud.
Oh, so this person had a history of bad financial decisions. Yeah. And like, so like one bounce check turns into a history of bad financial decisions and fraud. So that's where I'm like, I see where you're coming from. And I'm like, did he see one thing in one source and be like, oh, fraud.
Also, he said that Eric Freeman, who purchased the property, is a member of the Church of Satan, which I've got no beef with the Church of Satan.
Neither do I.
They have like really good principles and they don't actually worship Satan.
Common misconception.
However, he brings it up and he's like, he came from California, from Los Angeles. Your school has no gymnastics team. This is a last resort. No. He transferred from Los Angeles as a member of the Church of Satan. And then he talks about like bringing the Church of Satan to the house and having ceremonies there. And I'm like, I don't know if I believe any of your history now, which is...
I'm not inclined to want to buy this book at all.
No, I know. And that's why like bringing up the fraud thing and then being like, I didn't see anything about that in any of the other sources.
Mm-hmm.
That business had been open for over 100 years.
And sometimes just
businesses just fucking close.
The in our lifetime, the economy has been a fucking whirlwind.
Yes.
And I mean, just to be completely brutally honest, businesses that give back to the community unfortunately fail a lot more than businesses who are much more for profit. Because you have to have money come from somewhere. And if you work on the principles of the of a founder who is constantly trying to give back to the community, then the places that are not giving back to the community and are just taking all those profits for themselves are likely going to beat you. It's unfortunate and stupid, but it is the way the free market and capitalism works.
Also, it was passed down through generations of family.
Mm-hmm.
So his dad was the one who originally founded it, and then it was passed on to his adoptive son.
Yep.
This son would have been old by 2005. Yep. So maybe they closed the original location because it was old in and of itself, kept the other one up and going for 9 years. It just, it gave me bad vibes.
It could also just be that the family just was at the point where they're like, we just can't, this is not our, it takes a strength I can't even imagine to run a funeral home. That is sad work.
Yeah.
You're constantly surrounded by people that are grieving. Even if you're trying to go like drab to fab and make it a celebration, it's sad. I couldn't do it.
Right.
I seriously looked at being a mortician for a while. I was like, that's too much emotion. And it's a lot of school, but it's too much emotion.
I think I'd be fine with it if it wasn't so much gosh darn school. But yeah, anyway, I didn't like the fraud comment, and then I didn't like the tangent about the Church of Satan and then doing some sort of worships in the house. So a lot of the sources are based upon his book, like a lot of the quotes I had. A lot of them were from Medium.com, but half of them were from that guy, and I just, I don't know how I feel about it, but I wanted to put that disclaimer out there because I didn't want to fool you.
Legit.
You can ask your question now.
Well, I'm going to ask myself on a skeptic scale of para to normal. Para being 5, normal being 1. I think I'm going to give this place 3.5. Simply because I believe it could be haunted. Absolutely.
Right.
But then I'm also torn. Like, a guy who makes statements like that, I'm not as likely to believe his claims about the haunting activity.
Right.
I mean, I suppose it would help if I might be more inclined to give it a higher rating if I saw these videos he's referencing.
Right.
Where they caught his breath being seen and they caught the thing hopping off of his back or whatever.
Right.
So I might be, but I'm going to go 3.5. I feel confident in that rating.
Cool. I'm going to do 2.5.
Okay. Cool. We're more on par with each other than we were during that first story.
Whatever, I got you on my side. I got you on my side, Kayla. I talked you into it.
You know what? Favorite phrase, you wore me down. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have a listener story.
Yeah.
From the one, the only, the incomparable, Gina Gleason.
Gina McGleason.
I love Gina. All right, Gina says, hey, ladies, I've been meaning to send you some ghostly updates, but life's been lifin'.
I feel that.
First, big thank you to Brittany for covering central heterochromia. I also have central heterochromia.
Hello, fellow magic friend.
But never knew the name of it prior to your episode, which has me asking, is that why I'm such a ghost magnet? Yes, Gina, it probably is. You and Brittany are magical, and I am not. Give me your magic. Give me your eyes. No, okay.
Ew.
Back to Gina's story. Like you mentioned, you have to get pretty close up to see it. My central heterochromia is only became a topic of conversation in my household when I got LASIK and my eyes were projected onto a massive screen.
Yeah.
The nurse commented on how pretty gold rings around my pupils were, and my husband also had to pretend it wasn't his first time noticing it. As for Kayla's speculation about poor eye quality, I can attest that yes, my eyesight was terrible. Hence the need for LASIK. Regarding the mystical implications of central heterochromia that you shared, I am fascinated by how much of what you shared does align with my identity.
I know, right?
I am highly intuitive in nature and experience a certain degree of clairsentience and the occasional premonition. There are also a number of things that a psychic once told me that fit with various cultural beliefs that you shared. To preface this, I lean towards the skeptical side with psychics because there are so many phonies out there.
Yep.
But this psychic is a friend of a friend who is respected enough to serve as the go-to psychic for a bunch of Bravo pseudo celebrities. Without going on too much of a tangent, he shared a number of things with me that left zero doubt in my mind about his legitimacy. So to circle back to the topic of central heterochromia, he told me that I am an old soul with many past lives in which I have always gravitated toward helping wounded bird types.
Oh my God, that's exactly what all the things are.
Even in my current lifetime, I spent the first decade of my career running the art program for a school where the majority of the students were considered high needs. I won't even mention the type of men I used to gravitate. I can giggle because I know. I won't even mention the type of men I used to gravitate towards in my personal life. Oofta. I didn't say, that wasn't just me.
Same girl, same.
So all that touches directly on the traits of healing, leadership, and creativity that you listed. The psychic also told me that I have deeper emotional comprehension than the typical person and that I am more grounded in the physical world than most people who are spiritually in tune. This hits directly on what you mentioned about understanding both the physical and the spiritual world. Astrologically, my planetary placements also align with this idea of duality between water, earth, and spiritual physical. One interesting thing that the psychic mentioned was that whenever he envisioned me, he would see a gold ring radiating around me. I never connected that to the gold ring around my pupils. But now that you've got me wondering about that.
And you're a light worker.
Anyway, that's a lot about me, and I don't want to sound braggadocious, because a lot of those traits come with downsides too. I just found it so fascinating how closely all that aligned with what you shared about central heterochromia. More proof for the skeptic scale. And Kayla, I hope someday you get those red firepower eyes you desire, but you're special to me either way. Oh.
Destiny or not, you're still special to us both.
I do want red eyes, though. I have red contacts. I just want them all the time. Anyway, sorry. Second, I've got some ghost stories for you. Two of them, but today I'll share the shorter one. Because I've already rambled about my eyes for much longer than I intended.
I mean, they're so pretty and magical. What can you do?
Do you remember that time I made y'all cry about the strange events surrounding the death of my beloved dog?
Yes.
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 Yes, we do.
Uh-huh. That was mean.
So that was Devo. Welp, grab your tissues because I have an update. Back in October, I got COVID again. Damn those sneaky vaccine-evading variants. One night, during the worst of my symptoms, I climbed into bed and pulled the covers up over my face because I was going through the chills phase. While I was laying there, freezing my butt off in the heat, I felt my dog Riley jump up from the end of the bed and lay down alongside my knees. I was so pleasantly surprised because Riley had never wanted to sleep in the bed with me. I reached my hand out of the blankets to give her a reaffirming pat on the head, only to realize there was nothing there.
No, there was.
Riley was sound asleep in her crate, just like every other night. Devo, on the other hand, loved to sleep in the bed, pressed up against me, and would always insist on comforting me when I was sick. I am convinced that it had been him that jumped up on the bed to care for me that awful night.
Yeah.
If you remember my previous story, when ghostly Devo last came to visit, he appeared to have taught Riley some new habits. The same was true with this encounter. Following that night, Riley started to test the waters of sleeping in my bed, and now, months later, takes every opportunity she can to sneak in and join us for a bedtime snuggle.
Oh my God!
I miss Devo. Riley's cute. Riley's cutesy, though. Cute, cute, cute puppy.
It just warms my heart.
Yeah.
When animals come back, especially when you need them the most.
And then teach the new puppies new tricks. Oh, yeah. So good.
Like, no, you have to sleep in bed with her. This is how she feels better.
Yeah. And next up, another story about Kevin and his tendency to attract male moaning myrtles. Gina, I cannot wait.
I'm very excited. Stay tuned for future episodes of Left of Skeptic to find out, how does Kevin attract
male moaning myrtles?
Male moaning myrtles.
Oh, Kevin. It's so funny because he just like doesn't have any interest in that stuff. And he's just he's also a magnet for it.
I like the line she said about, and Kevin also had to pretend like he had definitely seen that before. Of course, you look deeply into my eyes quite often.
Oh, Gina, I love you and thank you for that story. If you, dear listeners, have a paranormal story you would like to share with us, you can do so by emailing us directly, leftofskeptic@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, www.leftofskeptic.com, and click the listener stories tab at the top of the page. Additionally, you can get there by clicking the link tree in our bio. You can choose to include your name or remain anonymous, whatever you are more comfortable with. We just ask that you please include your pronouns.
You can also follow us on social media. We are on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at Left of Skeptic and Facebook at Left of Skeptic Podcast.
Well, thank you all for joining us this spooky Wednesday. We love you and appreciate you.
It's true, we do.
Happy spooky Wednesday.
Happy spooky Wednesday. Okay, bye. The Left of Skeptic podcast is written and hosted by Kayla Moria and Brittany Lind. This week's episode is edited by me, Brittany Lind. The Left of Skeptic music is by Dave Melling and Emily Havoc, and our artwork is by Al LeBlanc. Okay, bye.
Did I make you angry with my nerd ass? You had such a brutal look on your face.
It was confused. It was like angry confusion.
You looked angry. You looked mad.
I'm like, I don't understand. I don't understand.
Even as you were like, beer first, you were giving me the stink eye.
Yeah. Yeah.